Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Podcast. It's Pradeep Mundra here. I'm a gastroenterologist in the UK and a podcast host. For this episode, this one is actually the part two of my conversation with Mette Hulsgaard on IBD and pregnancy. Mette is the associate professor of gastroenterology from Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark, specializing in IBD reproduction. Be sure you listen to the part one first in order to follow our discussion here. Now, in part one, we talked about fertility. You talked about preconception counseling, preconception optimization of patients now with IBD who wants to conceive. And we went through each class of drugs as to which ones to stop, which one to continue, which one to optimize. And the use of aspirin, which I was absolutely completely unaware of. In this part, we get into the depths of difficult conversations or difficult decisions or special circumstances where standard care may not be enough and you have to go slightly out of the main path, so to say. We also talk about acute severe colitis, surgery in acute severe colitis. We talk about methods of delivery. We also discuss about vaccination in the infants exposed to IBD drugs. And we also talk about the postpartum period, which I think is the part we all tend to forget. So here's the rest of the conversation. Enjoy. Can I ask you a slightly uncomfortable question, Mette? Let's say patient's got a flare or active disease and you want to treat during pregnancy and you don't have a choice of safer drugs, biologicals, newer biologicals, IL-23 inhibitors, and the only choice you have is JAK inhibitors. What is the trade-off here? Would you take a chance and give them JAK inhibitors, or would you kind of continue with sort of low-grade active disease, somehow trying to control the symptoms? Which is the bad person here, active disease or JAK inhibitors?
Active disease.
Okay.
That's the short answer. Yeah, so we know active disease poses an increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcome, even like mild active disease, if you could call that. But active disease is active disease. Of course, the increase for adverse pregnancy outcome increases with the severity of activity in the disease. But I would always aim for obtaining remission. And if the biologics have failed and we are dealing with a corticosteroid non-responder, or there's previously been side effects to corticosteroids, well, then I'll discuss with the patient saying, look, it's too early to induce delivery because it's only like second trimester or beginning of the third trimester. And we have other types of drugs, fast-acting drugs, but with limited safety data. I would highlight what we know regarding exposure during pregnancy. And then keep in mind that for tofacitinib and upadacitinib, there's been no reports of increased risk of fetal death in the animal studies either. There was only like the link to malformations. Again, malformations which we haven't seen in human data. So I would definitely, if the patient agrees to it, I would induce and start JAK inhibitors in pregnancy. And as I mentioned early on in our talk, I have actually already done so because of a patient in severe active disease at gestation week 28. We had no other option and the mother agreed and we initiated upadacitinib. And 2 days after, the patient was actually showing signs of remission, markedly reduced bowel movements, went into remission during the third trimester and gave birth at term. So this is really on an individual level, we need these types of discussions. And preferably, refer your patient to a center with expertise in this field, or even like a phone consultation if you live far away from that particular expert within this field.
Okay. Mette, on the note of active disease, I think as clinicians, we're very comfortable continuing drugs that they were on previously. It's about initiating new drugs that we get nervous and concerned about. So what you're trying to highlight is you would manage them as you would do with any other patient. Actually, more importance to managing the active disease because that improves outcomes. And you would initiate any treatment as usual. But is there anything about any particular, other than the JAK inhibitors, S1Ps, is there any other medication that you would be cautious about initiating during pregnancy?
So I would never initiate fipurines. We don't really use fipurines that much anymore because we have so many biologics, and I would prefer those in our patients, also in the non-pregnant patients. But I would never initiate fipurines because it's a slow-acting drug, first of all, and then the risk of like side effects like pancreatitis, hepatitis. But when you have active disease, you really need a drug of choice which works fast. And thiopurines, it takes time, it builds up in the system, and you don't have that time to wait in a pregnant patient. And also the risk of side effects to the drug. So never initiate thiopurines. You can, if a patient falls pregnant on thiopurines, you can continue it throughout pregnancy in case of monotherapy, as mentioned early on. So, but yeah, never use thiopurines. And of course, obviously, as we discussed, methotrexate should be stopped. And of course, should never be initiated either. So, but the biologics, really keep them in mind. Some of them are fast acting and they should be initiated in case of active disease. And in case you have failed a TNF-alpha inhibitor and you want to use another biologic in case of active disease in pregnancy, well, initiate those type of biologics in pregnancy and potentially bridging with budesonide for a period of time in order to ensure remission. Or if budesonide isn't sufficient for the bridging period, then systemic corticosteroids, but for the shortest possible duration of time.
And on that note, any words of wisdom in terms of managing patients with acute severe colitis in pregnancy? The reason why I ask, I still remember this case where I was a trainee, the first year trainee in gastroenterology, 22-week pregnant lady came in, and there was a bit of reluctance to use any drugs beyond steroids, but this was a long time ago. Eventually, unfortunately, you know, even the reluctance to do surgery on this patient to an extent that the surgery was only conducted when her colon had toxic dilatation. It was like 5-6 centimeters wide, and she was not responding. Luckily, you know, she recovered well and the baby was born healthy at term and all that. So any words of wisdom or anything the trainees or any of us general gastroenterologists need to know in managing the acute severe colitis?
So the worst thing we can do is under treatment. I think I've said that quite a few times now. So, but in case, especially in case of acute severe ulcerative colitis, you need to be aggressive. So high dose corticosteroids, definitely intravenous admission to the department so you can monitor mom and infant. While being admitted to the inpatient ward, you can get obstetrician to see the patient, monitor the fecal rate and so on. So high dose intravenous corticosteroids, induce biologics. So we have like a bridging to ensure remission, not just in pregnancy, but also postpartum. That's a very important period of time as well. So you need a management plan, and not just here and now, but also moving on onward. So treat active disease aggressively, just as in the non-pregnant patients. When it comes to surgery, it is so important that we not just try and wait to see how it goes. We need to, first of all, highly recommendable, refer pregnant patients with acute severe ulcerative colitis to a tertiary referral hospital, because those centers, they have the knowledge and the capability of performing these high-risk operations. We know the perfect timing for doing like colectomy and operations in general on the bowel in pregnancy is during the second trimester. But that should never guide our decision when to perform surgery. It is really the patient's clinical conditions which should guide us. So if surgery during the first trimester is needed, it should be performed then. And also if needed early in the third trimester, or if it's later in the third trimester, again, in sort of a multidisciplinary approach with our obstetricians as well, surgery in combination with elective cesarean section or emergency cesarean section, it all depends on gestational week. What is important, though, to note is that both maternal and neonatal mortality in case of surgery has decreased during the past decades. We showed that in a large European study. And that is most likely due to we are better at referring to tertiary referral hospitals, skilled surgical surgeons, and also more like less invasive surgery with laparoscopic surgery as well in the pregnant patient. And another important point is that risk of abortion and stillbirth in case of surgery in pregnancy is highest during the first 2 weeks after surgery. So the first 2 weeks are really the period of time where we should monitor our patient clearly, but also inform the patient that after 2 weeks post-surgery, she is sort of out of the woods, but of course monitor these patients clearly, but never postpone time for surgery. Refer to high like tertiary referral centers.
Yeah, I guess a point to highlight is to involve the obstetricians all along because monitoring of the baby.
And surgeon.
And surgery, of course, yeah. Are there anything to consider in terms of mode of delivery? Sort of any advice? I know it's a forte of obstetricians, but anything that we need to know in terms of IBD itself?
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing is multidisciplinary management. Have a great dialogue with the patient, like patient involvement and with the obstetric department. But there are, of course, special considerations for our RBD patients. So in case of active perianal disease, there is a 10-time increased risk of sphincter tear. So in case of active perianal disease, always the cesarean section. But also in case of women with a pouch or those who are high likelihood of having a pouch in the future, you should discuss having a cesarean section. I personally always recommend cesarean section in my patients with a pouch because you need to take extra care of the sphincter in those patients. But it all comes down to that our patients need to feel safe and secure going into delivery. So one size doesn't fit all. That's why the MDT is so important and multidisciplinary involvement and patient involvement deciding on mode of delivery.
Okay, maybe it's time to move on to vaccinations, Mette. In brief, you know, what are the things, what advice would you give? Because that's one of the concerns brought up and I'm always confused and I'm just looking at guidelines and things. So just some in brief, what are the vaccination to avoid? How do you counsel patients? How do you counsel pregnant women?
Yeah, so I think the concern really rises because we have seen that in infants exposed to biologics, there's been 5 cases of death in infants exposed to a TNF-alpha inhibitor. These infants were exposed to either infliximab or adalimumab during pregnancy and received the live attenuated BCG vaccine, and those infants died of disseminated BCG infection. So that really raised a huge concern when we saw the first case published more than a decade ago. So when it comes to biologics, infants exposed to biologics, we know the biologics are present for the first 6 months after delivery. For infliximab, up to a small percentage will have detectable infliximab levels at a very low concentration up to the age of 12 months. But for all the other biologics, it will be cleared within the first 6 months of life. So when it comes to inactive vaccines, like all the standard inactive vaccines, those can be given on schedule to all infants exposed to biologics. So follow the National Immunization Program, and I highly recommend that. And another good thing is that we have seen when it comes to the inactive vaccines, no adverse risk of adverse events. And we have seen adequate serologic response to vaccines as well. And that's important to highlight to the moms or to the parents overall. When it comes to live attenuated vaccines, except rotavirus vaccine, avoid these vaccines for the first 6 months of life. Of course, like regional risk should be taken into account. If you live in a country with a high risk of tuberculosis, then pros and cons should be weighed. And being exposed to infliximab, where we have this prolonged clearance, and if a BCG vaccine is needed, well, you could also, after the 6 months of age, we could also measure if there's any like levels detectable still and like test the immunological assessment. But really, most Even in Europe, BCG vaccine is recommended in some countries, or at least in populations highly at risk of tuberculosis. So to keep it simple, avoid live vaccines for the first 6 months of life in case of biological exposure. When it comes to rotavirus vaccine, and that's new, and we have really explained this in detail in our new global consensus, but rotavirus vaccine can actually be given on schedule in infants exposed to biologics. And that's because the Canadian Immunization Research Network, they did a splendid study. They included nearly 200 infants exposed to biologics in pregnancy, the vast majority exposed during the third trimester as well. And they did extensive immunological assessment, and they found completely normal immunological assessment in 98% of infants. And they recommended rotavirus vaccine, most received it, and they saw no adverse reactions. Even in those infants, we had a high level of biologicals at the time of vaccine. So really, rotavirus vaccine can be given on schedule if it's a part of the national immunization program.
Okay, that's well summarized. That actually makes it much more simpler, right? It seems much more simpler than I thought.
That's what we need. We need simple advice and so simple recommendations so clinicians remember it and the patients remember it as well.
Absolutely. Moving on to briefly about the postpartum period, can you think of any special points to highlight? Because that's something I think patients don't come to you because they're very busy with their lives. Moms are very busy. It's probably the most busiest time and they will not come to your appointments and things. So something you need to plan before delivery, I guess. So any words of wisdom?
Yeah, so I always address the postpartum period for the exact same reason as I just highlighted. So I discuss the postpartum period already during pregnancy because it seems to me that our patients accept that medical treatment during pregnancy is needed to ensure both maternal but also fetal health. But once you're giving birth and you sit there and they're breastfeeding, they get all concerned about the drugs. And the likelihood of non-adherence to medical treatment increases during the postpartum period. So again, highlight the importance of staying on the drugs in order to ensure remission, because women with IBD, they are at increased risk of postpartum flaring, especially in case of course, non-compliance to medical treatment. Also, if they have discontinued biologics in the third trimester in pregnancy, and again, off note, one should never discontinue biologics in pregnancy. We used to say that in the old days in Europe, but we do not recommend this anymore. Because we have so much safety data on newborn exposure. So really continue biologics throughout pregnancy to ensure remission, not just in pregnancy, but also during the postpartum period. And again, because of the hormonal changes and stress of becoming a mom, sleep deprivation and so on, they are at increased risk of flaring. So staying adherent to medical treatment is of utmost importance. Another important aspect I always address to my patients, especially if the partner is in the consultation as well during pregnancy, is that women with IBD are actually at a slight increased risk of postpartum depression compared to the background population. And it's just important that the women, and especially the spouse, is aware of this, so precautions can be taken in case our patients show signs of depression. Early intervention is, of course, of utmost importance also in that matter. It is not us as gastroenterologists, that's the GP, maternal health nurse coming to their home and so on, and relatives and so on should be aware of how the mom is doing, but we just need to raise awareness regarding this point.
Mati, with that, it brings us towards the end of the conversation. Thanks for your time for the last hour. You made it very clear, simple for us to understand. And thanks for the amazing guidelines, the consensus statement the team of you have put up, which is very simple, succinct, and makes it much easier for others to follow. Any final thoughts, words of wisdom, or a piece of advice?
Yeah, so really one sentence: healthy mom, healthy baby. And in order to ensure a healthy baby, remission in maternal disease is of utmost importance. So please, aggressiveness with the different medical drugs is of great importance. Use biologics also as induction in pregnancy. Always patient involvement. That is really the key message. Healthy mom, healthy baby.
Okay. Thanks for your time. Good day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.